Okay, let's walk over. We're going to cross this bridge.
Just outside Longmont, on North 119th Street, there is a long, big building surrounded by open land. From the road, it is easy to miss. And for years, people drove past without knowing what it was or whose lives had unfolded inside. But this is Las Barracas. It is one of the last physical reminders of the Mexican and Mexican-American farm workers who helped sustain Boulder County's agricultural economy. On a hot summer evening, I joined a group from historic Boulder to visit the site.
The farms where Japanese American folks were working, because it seems that they basically only hired Latino labor.
Only one barrack remains. Its windows are damaged, the building is deteriorating and closed to visitors. But as we begin walking around it, the place slowly comes alive through the stories of the families who live there.
Folks that we have interviewed here to be a part of, you know, putting this back together.
Before giving us the history, Elizabeth Rios Brooks asked us to pause, to look around, and to imagine daily life in this place.
Yeah, why don't you take some time to think about what it would have smelled like, what it would have felt like, and we can rendezvous on the other side of the building.
Elizabeth Rios Brooks is the Cultural Resource Program Coordinator for Boulder County Parks and Open Space. She helped organize this visit as part of Boulder County's Latine and Chicano Historic Context Study. The study is recovering the histories of Latino and Chicano families whose labor, leadership, and culture have shaped this county for generations. Dr. Becky Chavez is the founder of Rooted Pathways Leadership and a consultant on the project. She helped guide us through the site.
I am Dra. Becky Chavez from Rooted Pathways Leadership, and I am a consultant with Parks and Open Space on the Latine and Chicano Historic Context Study. And right now we are at Las Barracas. It is a hot evening in Colorado, and we have folks from History Boulder touring the site, walking around right now, trying to get a feel of what it would be like to live here, to grow up here, to work here, to thrive here.
So what is basically Las Barracas? What is this historic place, if you can describe it briefly to our listeners?
Las Barracas is a old military barracks. There were three of them. They were long barracks. Each of them were broken up into about four different units, and they came from Buckley Air Force Base to house the workers. And here we had three units with bathrooms in between that were communal and everybody shared. Right now there is one remaining. There was once a push to destroy it, but somebody advocated to keep it, recognizing how important it is to Latino history here in Boulder County.
And this is an effort of a couple of organizations behind this effort of keeping the history alive. If you can speak about that too.
This project was really dreamed up by Elizabeth Rios Brooks with Boulder County Parks and Open Space. When she started in her position about a year and a half ago, she started looking at the different sites, and Las Barracas is the only physical site that she could find that was connected to Latine history here. And she was actually able to get it on Latinos in Heritage Conservation's inaugural Endangered Latinx list.
Four generations, Latino workers planted and harvested the crops that made Boulder County agriculture possible. They helped build the local economy, but their names, their homes, and their daily experiences were often missed from the official history. Becky says the remaining barraca gives that history a physical presence.
I feel that a lot of times Latino history is forgotten, erased, or minimized. And having this physical presence where I've been in the Longmont area for 16 years, and I would drive by it, and I never knew what it was. I was just, oh, look at that old abandoned building over there. And once I started working on this project and learning about the risk history and the connection to the community that it has, and the connection it has to my own family history, it's important to get these voices heard that were never heard before. And we've had a lot of people say, oh, I never thought my story was important. I was just a worker, or my family was a foreman, and I didn't think my story mattered. And we need folks to realize how important their story is to where we are today. And we're also seeing the legacy that these families have who stayed and what they're doing in the Longmont or Boulder County communities now.
It's history after all. Let's go find the group who's going around and is going to go look for a tree. What is this tree, if you can also explain as we're walking there?
There was a pine tree that was planted by Manuel Salomon when one of his sons was born. And they wrapped the umbilical cord around it and planted it outside the house that they occupied. Manuel was a foreman for Dick Tanaka, and the family worked for them really till the very end. Manuel took over the job of foreman from his father. So it's generations of Salomons who are a part of this history of Las Barajas.
Recovering those voices requires more than documenting an old building. It means returning to census records, newspapers, property documents, and family photographs. And it also means preparing a new generation to ask who may be missing from those records.
Most of them are Latina, from CU Boulder, CU Denver, Regis University, and Metro State University. And then this current phase, we have four who continued and one lead research assistant who is a PhD student at CU Boulder.
Paid students, researchers from universities across Colorado have been helping with that work. They are examining sites already recognized and historically significant and asking whether Latino and Chicano experiences were left out of their official stories. But the archives could only provide part of the history. Some of the most important discoveries came from people who recognized their own families in old interviews and photographs. Elizabeth says one breakthrough happened online.
It's a community-based page, and I noted that somebody had put one of the interviews that I had done on that site. And I don't usually hang out there. It can be a little bit of a mixed bag, if you will, as Facebook tends to be. And so lo and behold, all of these comments start popping up. Oh, my grandma used to work there. My mom used to live there. I know people who worked there.
The history was not gone. It was living in families across Longmont and Boulder County. It was present in people who had worked for the Tanakas, gone to school nearby, or hear their parents and grandparents talk about life in the fields. But many of them did not know their memories matter to the public record. As we stand beside the remaining barraca, Elizabeth passes around photographs showing the three original buildings. During the busiest agricultural seasons, the rooms could become overcrowded. Some workers also stay in trails and cars around the property. There was little privacy.
They're pretty barren, right? They're World War II barracks. There isn't exactly insulation. There's also originally no running water, and then that was later installed. Additionally, there were sort of houses around. There was a house over here. There was a house closer to the road where other families would live. And this is a cinder block house where different vegetables were also kept.
Women and men work in the fields. Young children sometimes waited in cars parked near their parents. Children who were old enough could also be expected to work. Many families travel from Texas and other states for the agricultural season. That meant children could miss 4 to 6 months of school. Migrant education programs eventually began transporting them from Las Barracas to schools including Columbine and Indian Peaks. The bus came directly to the property.
Did women work in the... Yes,
well, they did.
In the fields or in the...
Yeah.
Yes. So both women and men worked in the fields. Really, originally, they would bring their kids, like, in their car, or they would park them right outside the field. If they were old enough to walk, basically, they would also be in the field with the parents. And if you think about it, kids that are in school in Texas and come here to migrate for a few months, they're going to miss a lot of school. So what happens? At some point, the government decides, like, wow, there's an enormous amount of children that are not passing their grades because they're leaving for 4 to 6 months at a time during the field season, especially the older kids. So Migrant Summer Education Program starts. And that sort of changed things for a lot of people. Now, folks were coming and saying, your kids can't just be out here. We're going to take them on a bus and we're going to go to school.
So what year will that have been?
In the 70s.
70s?
Wow.
70. And one of those schools was Columbine, if anybody knows that school, for Indian Peaks as well. And the bus would come and pick kids up literally right here and take them to school. And most of them were Spanish speaking. We also know that they were provided with health care. So there was a doctor that would look at their eyes, people that would check their teeth. And part of the reason was because there was a lot of racism at the time here in Longmont. And so people would be turned away if they had medical necessities. The only time that we know they wouldn't was if a woman was literally about to give birth. If she was giving birth, she would be allowed in. Otherwise, she would be turned away.
The programs also connected families with medical and dental care. According to the project's research, discrimination made it difficult for some Latino workers to receive care elsewhere in Longmont. These details reveal the system surrounding Las Barracas, but official records cannot fully communicate what it felt like to live here. For that, Elizabeth turns to the words of former residents. Standing in the shade provided by the barraca, she begins reading from archival newspaper accounts.
So now I want to read you some newspaper clippings so you can hear directly from the people that lived here. It says, Life on Tanaka Farms. Let's see. Nancy Garcia, 20, visits at the Tanaka Farm Workers Housing where her parents live on 119th Street. Garcia left Erie High School last year before she graduated to get married. She lives in Longmont. Let's see. Tobar wants Tanaka Farms to repair the holes in the wall of the home. We tell them too many times, but they don't listen, she says. She's also asked for paint. Just paint to paint the house, she says. We asked Sam Tanaka, but he said nothing, so I didn't ask no more. They also talk about how Tanaka Farms workers live in about 9 Boulder County camps. All are sparsely furnished with refrigerator, stove, beds, and tables. All workers who live in the barracks share community bathrooms. There are no flowers, grass, or trees on the grounds. Some barracks adjoin junkyards where wrecked cars and farming equipment are dumped. Workers who live in the barracks share a bath divided by men and women. In each section, 2 toilets sit side by side in a cinder block enclosure with no partitions. Communal showers offer little privacy. Floors are raw concrete. And that was 1988.
That testimony was published in 1988. The reporting described barracks furnished with little more than fridges, stoves, beds, and tables. Residents share bathrooms with concrete floors, toilets, without partition and communal showers. That same year, the U.S. Department of Labor sued Tanaka Brothers Farms over violations of federal labor and housing laws. By the early 1990s, foreclosure and bankruptcy threatened the homes of workers who have lived on the property for years. Paula Morales was raising 5 children. She worried about finding another place to live and about having to move their daughters away from their schools.
So as there was more media pressure, there was more, people started hearing about this other side of Longmont that they really didn't know of, Boulder County. Because these barracks, like we read, were sparsely situated throughout the county, but in places that you wouldn't necessarily see them, apparently. And so that's when Boulder County Housing Authority got involved and said, you need to do something about this. And so the Tanakas initially did work with them, but after some time, the conditions continued to deteriorate. And I will read you another piece. So at that point, they're sued by the federal government because of the poor housing conditions. And at that point, they're forced to evict everyone, basically, from day to night. So this is Paula Morales. The first day I heard all this, I got sick. There's so much worry. Everything just gets to you, she said. We can make it. We're going to do it. What else can we do in a situation like this? I have to have a real good job to pay for these kids. I have to get a job. I have to. She worries about having to move her children, girls ages 11, 8, and 5, and 2-year-old twin boys. The older girls don't want to have to change schools. We're really happy here because we have everything. I don't have to worry about the children getting into the neighbor's yard. It's real quiet. We have freedom to do what we please. With Tanaka, I'm grateful all these years they gave us a good life. Now this has happened. Everybody's just going to have to go their own way. And now I'll read you Mary Lopez and Carlos Morales. Mary Lopez says, her family has to vacate the apartment on Monday, and they're not going without a fight. She refuses to move her family unless they have a place to go. They can't just throw us out in the snow to nothing. I feel depressed. I feel angered. I want to scream and holler, she said. You get so depressed from hearing all these promises, and the promises are nothing but air. You can't run away from the problem. It's still here. We're just going to have to stick it out. Next is Carlos Morales. Morales, 44, worked for the Tanakas for 21 years before the foreclosure of a large chunk of their land last year, and he's lived in a mobile home on the property for about 15 years. He says, they should have told us ahead of time. We've been helping Tanaka so long, we could have not gone to Mexico and looked for another job instead. They expect us to get out and go look for something. It's not that easy, especially at this time of year. For his own family, he just wants a house similar to the one where he lives. Nothing fancy, he said. I've always had a house and a job right away as soon as I got back from Mexico. Now everything is different. 20 years is a long time, and we're going to have to start from the bottom, and it's really hard.
A lot. Did you find those webs?
So we haven't actually found these folks, but other folks that have shown up in these newspaper articles, we have. And we have done oral history interviews with them. And it's been pretty amazing, specifically Margarita and Manuel Salomon. So they lived in the house that was really close to the road over here. The building is no longer there, but
pine tree.
There's a pine tree right next to where the house was. And something that they shared in their oral history was that pine tree was planted when one of their sons was born, and they actually wrapped the umbilical cord around the pine like seed. And so it's still there. And that's something we would have never known. That's a very real mark of the fact that they lived here and they loved this area.
Researchers have not located every former resident name in the newspaper's articles, but they have found others, including Margarita and Manuel Salomon. Their oral history offers something the newspapers could not fully capture. It remembers the hardship, but it also remembers friendship, family, and joy.
Which is a really important part of this research. I think especially, I don't know, for me, I really wanted to make sure that we didn't just capture one specific part. The newspaper clippings that I have and that I've read, among many, many others, definitely paint the Tanakas in a very specific light. But the oral histories have revealed, at least when it comes to Dick Tanaka in particular, who was the person who oversaw this land and the farm workers here, as well as these farms, was a very kind person. And I'll give you an example that Debbie and Charlotte gave us. So there would be times where the equivalent of ICE would come, which was called La Migra. And so they would come relatively often and pick people up. And so what we were told, actually it was Margarita who told us this, that Dick went around and actually installed these loudspeakers at all the farms, and he would press a button when they knew that they were pulling up so that they could run. And we know that the Tanakas were hiring documented and undocumented people. And during the Reagan administration, when there was amnesty, he helped many, many people get their papers. And so that's also an important part of this story that is missing from these newspaper articles, which is, as historians, we're constantly thinking of what narratives aren't being shared here. Whose approaches are we, how can we read between the lines? And so the oral histories have done a really good job of shining a light, a different light on the Tanakas than what is seen in these newspaper articles. And then also talking about what it would have been like to live here. What would it been like to be here? And so I would like to show you some pictures of what it was like inside these barracks. They were in there. In the picture, there is a picture of the inside. You can see the sink.
Shared cooking? Or
each family. So it was four sort of rooms, and that included the kitchen area. The fact that they got sued by the federal government, had to liquidate their assets, like they weren't able to pay any of it back, is definitely what led to the decline. They had to immediately move out of where they were living, the Tanakas, and move into, I think it was a two-bedroom space with another family that was kind enough to open their arms to them.
I believe it was another Japanese American family. So they basically lost all of it. I know that Dick Tanaka afterward did start to try and farm another small plot of land, but it, after he passed away, it didn't go on, and it wasn't nearly as successful as this was at its peak. And it's important to mention that the Tanakas were not the only people doing this. There was a lot of farmers at this time, not just Japanese American, we're also talking about white, who had the same conditions. So it's an interesting question to ask yourself, huh, like why them? And I think that's also an important part of being a historian, of asking those difficult questions, especially thinking about Japanese incarceration. There would have been a lot of racism and discrimination against Japanese American folks, against Latino people as well at the time. But it's just a question that I also ask myself all the time. But I would like to show you pictures. I know we're running really short on time, of the inside. So this is Juan Salomon, which is the son of Margarita and Manuel. Manuel was like the left-hand man to Dick Tanaka, hence why he lived in the house. Their family lived here year-round. So most of the folks were seasonal, but the people that lived in these barracks actually typically lived here year-round. And it was families. So there were some barracks that were only for single men. These were specifically for families. So I love this picture of him sleeping in this red bed. And this red bed, Margarita describes, when they grew out of it, it would just be passed down from room to room to the rest of the kids. And it made its way up and down the barracks year after year. And I just love this picture. This is also Juan and his friends at a birthday party. And they're hanging out right here. And I think Margarita said that there was candy and they were just hanging out, having a good time. And you can see there are cars in the background. The ground doesn't look exactly like it's flourishing. It would have been a hard place to live, but there's still joy, right? Like, there's still these moments captured.
And one thing that we've heard over and over from folks is they didn't have a lot. Looking back, they know they didn't have a lot and they were poor, but at the time they didn't know. They didn't know what they didn't know. And it was a time in their life, like Juan, he talks about, it was one of the best times of his life growing up here at the Barafa site.
And there is a little, the creek that runs right through here. And they would talk about like jumping in there on really hot days and hanging out, and how this area was called El Bosque, which means the forest in Spanish. And it was their treasure area. And there would be like junk cars and all kinds of things. And they would go run and get into shenanigans like kids do. This, I really like this picture as well. And this is Juan laying on this shag carpet, this classic sort of couch. I feel like we can all relate to being a child and hanging out on a shag carpet and just resting like kids do, right? Like they don't know. And so I really appreciate this picture.
Dilly wasn't going to buy one.
This is their father, Manuel. And I really appreciate this picture because we don't often see people who labor in the fields at rest. And this is, to me, probably a Sunday, probably one of those hours where he wasn't working. We know that folks worked from sun up to sundown. The sun is really what dictated how long they would work. We know that in the summers, the sun is out for a very long time. And especially a day like today is really hot, if you can imagine being in the fields. And so these moments where he's resting with his children on top of him, I think are really intimate and really special. And what a privilege that we are able to have a glimpse into someone's life. And the first time we see snow. I love this picture too. Everyone is smiling and having a great time. Some people are missing jackets, which would have definitely been me. But there's something so special about seeing people experiencing something for the first time. And Margarita, what is so cool about Margarita is that she'll be like, oh yeah, that's this person and this person and this person. And then she'll give me their phone numbers.
The oral histories do not erase the unsafe conditions. They make the history more complete. Exploitation, solidarity, fear, gratitude, and human relationships can all exist within the same story. Near the place where the Salomon family's house once stood, a pine tree is still growing. Without the Salomon family's oral history, that pine might look like any other tree. Now it makes a birth, a home, and a family's deep connection to this land. As the visit comes to an end, the questions turn toward the future. How much would it be to put it back where you could turn it into a museum or have people visit?
Looking for funds to
rehab
the building.
I am working with the State Historical Fund, History Colorado. We have a strategy. It's like a 10, 15 year strategy because I have to apply for grants every year until.
How much would it be to put it back where you could turn it into a museum or have people visit? How much would that be?
I don't know if I can give you a number off the top of my head without having someone come in and take a look at it. However, I will tell you that there is asbestos in there, that there's quite a lot of critters in there, that there have been break-ins. If you can see, people, houseless folks have gone inside. And I think we put in something like $90,000 we requested from our internal funds to try and do that remediation as well as paint. I think it would be really amazing to get the community out here. These folks that we have interviewed here to be a part of putting this back together.
Yeah. And one part of this process is we're not just, great, we're taking your old history. We are going to put it out in a report or some other project and be extractive. We want to make what this becomes or what it could become based on policies and processes, of course, is what the community wants it to become and what we want it to see. Is it a meeting space? Does it stay the way it is, but we have interpretive signs? Or do we make it a whole cultural center museum where people can come and meet and learn this history of Boulder County that is not in any sites?
In 2025, Las Barracas received national recognition when Latinos in Heritage Conservation included it on its inaugural list of endangered Latinx landmarks. That recognition does not guarantee the building will be restored, but it makes a public statement. This place matters. Las Barracas is more than an abandoned building. It is one of Boulder County's last physical connections to generations of Mexican and Mexican-American agricultural workers. Its walls hold evidence of overcrowding, unsafe housing, and exclusion. Its family photographs hold something else. Children playing, parents resting, birthdays celebrated, neighbors helping one another, families creating joy and belonging under difficult circumstances. For too long, the people who live here appear in the public record mainly as workers. The oral histories return their humanity. They were parents and children, interpreters and caregivers, friends and neighbors, people whose labor helped build Boulder County and whose families are still part of this community today. Latino families did not recently arrive in Boulder County's history. They have lived it, worked it, and shaped it for generations. The remaining barrack or barraca gives that history a physical place. The oral histories give it names and voices. And the pine tree beside, it reminds us that history does not survive only in government reports or official archives. Sometimes it survives in a building people pass for years without recognizing. Sometimes it survives in a small red bed passed from one child to another one. And sometimes it survives in a tree planted to welcome a new life. To read the full Phase 1 report and learn more about Boulder County's Latin and Chicano historic context study, visit the project page linked with this history at kgnu.org. Or KGNU, I am Rosana Longobetter.